I will just do the roll call quickly. I'll just call out names and we'll do it from there. So Jim Hanafy?
Here.
Paige McGilloway?
Here.
Felix Briones?
Here.
Mark Gold?
I'm here.
Gene Langendorf?
Here.
And Jonas Schwartz?
Here.
All right, did I miss anyone? All right, yep, I knew that Paula and Mike were going to be absent, so we're good. So, Jonas.
Okay, so our charge today is to, because you didn't send out an agenda for this, did you?
Yes.
I did, actually. I sent it out on Wednesday. But it's okay. I know that you were at the summit. If you'd like, I can go through the agenda.
That would be helpful.
No problem. So the email I sent out just said that the agenda for today, as we had discussed at our last conference call, would be about identifying barriers and that chapter, which is chapter 5 of the biennial plan. So that's what we're going to try to go into today. Before we do that, a couple of housekeeping things. First, approval of the April 15th meeting minutes, and those were attached electronically to the email I sent out on Wednesday. And did everyone get that?
Yes,
yeah, I did.
Okay. I just want to make sure that I wasn't leaving anyone out. So are there any changes, any comments on the meeting minutes?
I don't have any.
Nope.
None.
All right. So do we want to vote to approve the meeting minutes?
Paige to move to approve.
All right. Paige moves. Anyone second?
I second.
All right. All those in favor of approving the meeting minutes as written?
Aye.
Aye.
Raise your hand.
Aye. So that's one.
Anyone opposed? Okay. So we have the meeting minutes approved. And as you know, at the end of our call on the 15th, I just discussed briefly about staff assignments, and I wanted to tell you guys a little bit about the research that Marshall and I have undertaken specifically for that chapter that we discussed on the 15th, as well as other chapters that were brought up during our discussion. So just to start off, I created a draft preamble and a draft of the chapter given all of the feedback, and that is now in Jonas's capable hands, and he's going to look it over for me and give me any feedback as the chair, and then I will send it out to everyone and get feedback and discussion on that draft of Chapter 3 and the draft preamble.
Okay, so just to clarify, I was the only one that got those?
Yes, Jonas, you're my chair.
Okay. All right.
Okay. I wanted to have a set of eyes to make sure that I was on the right track, because otherwise I need to, you know, if I need to make substantial changes, then I'll make those changes before it goes out to the whole committee.
Okay.
And so that was done. Also, I put together some profiles, I think we called them profiles, of based on the transcripts from the public forums, people who gave, you know, a personal story or referenced an experience of somebody who is in need of the type of assistance that hopefully we will be able to recommend providing through service-enriched housing. I put together some of those profiles. It's a pretty long document, so hopefully Jonas and Marshall can help me pare it down. I have, I think, 10 pages worth of profiles, so we should pick some gems, and then we will give those to you guys to look at. And another thing that both Marshall and I have been doing is doing some research based on the data sources that you all reference that we should look at for gathering basically some good quantitative and qualitative data about the need for persons with disabilities and persons who are elderly. So some great studies that I will be using and referencing in our biennial plan. I think you guys remember at the Austin Public Forum, Pat Towne came and talked about the National Council on Disability, and one of the great documents that they just published January of this year is The State of Housing in America in the 21st Century, a Disability Perspective. And so it is a large document, but I have read most of it and has a lot of good information that I think helps kind of give some background to the need that exists for persons with disabilities for community-based care or community-based services and supports. So that's a good one. Also, from the Administration on Aging, they have a great profile of older Americans that came out last year that I'm going to be using, as well as there's something called the Federal Interagency Forum on Aging-Related Statistics, and they have a great Older Americans 2008 Key Indicators of Well-Being, which has a lot of great information. So using all those sources, as well as some others that from the AARP and ones that Marshall is continuing to research. So I think we have a good start on the data that we'll be using throughout the biennial plan. So that being said, I just wanted to tell you guys where stuff was in terms of those research efforts. And so that being said, I think we should probably move on to discussing Chapter 5, which is the Identifying Barriers chapter. And I had made up just a quick little discussion handout, which was really just what the statutory directive is, which is identifying barriers preventing or slowing service-enriched housing efforts, including barriers attributable to, and then the three factors that we wanted to discuss were regulatory requirements and limitations, administrative limitations, and limitations on funding. So I think maybe we could just take them one at a time, if that's okay with you guys, and start with regulatory requirements and limitations, and to just specify, I think we were looking at state and federal laws and regulations rather than agency policies. So if we want to start out with that, anyone have any barriers to give me?
Well, I don't know if this is a barrier per se, but in terms of long-term services and supports, if you're looking at a very poor population, then Medicaid certainly has certain eligibility restrictions, both in terms of financial and functional, in terms of what can be delivered. So, again, I don't know if it's a barrier as much as a statement of fact. And individuals who fall outside of those Medicaid requirements, then the state doesn't offer a lot of general revenue-funded social services. Now, I realize it's on a state level, certainly city and county municipalities offer certain sort of services. And if we're talking about behavioral health specifically, that's very true because there's not even a lot of Medicaid services that are available there, let alone general revenue services. So that's sort of a scope of some of the issues from the state perspective.
So, Mark, if I could ask kind of a follow-up on that.
Sure.
What would you say in terms of those eligibility restrictions for receiving Medicaid services and supports? Which of those restrictions do you think are the biggest hindrance, like the largest portion of people are being, you know, maybe left out or not able to access?
Well, again, you know, we address a very, very poor population. It goes from SSI, which is $694 per month, up to three times that. So even if you're very, very poor, you're not going to fall within that catchment sort of area. And then the resource limitations are $10,000 for an individual, $10,000 for a couple. So, I mean, that is certainly a restriction from people who just are a little above that 300% of SSI to get certain types of services. And for some of our programs, you're just at the SSI level, so that's very restrictive in terms of what's going to be out there. But then, too, on the functional level, we have a very stringent requirement, certainly for our waiver programs, that they have to fall off an institutional level of need, and then also in order to get some of our other programs, we keep that level relatively stringent in terms of who can qualify or not. So I think they need to be at least, if not presented as barriers per se, but at least just like statements that, you know, we don't have a lot of general revenue programs really to serve people who may just be poor.
Mm-hmm.
Or need, and especially on the behavioral health side, I mean, those services are, from a state perspective, are pretty limited.
Mm-hmm.
And substance abuse is very, very limited in terms of sort of services that we're providing also.
Okay. Anyone else want to jump in?
I'm not sure if this is, it kind of ties to that. I pulled these out and kind of passed them around my staff, and it may fall into the second bullet, some of the stuff for policies with us, but we have found over the years in for various programs that by folks going to work, they're eligible when they start the program, but then they make enough money that they begin to fall out of eligibility, and I don't know if that will apply here or not, but you know, more and more of our consumers are going to work full-time at or above, SGA, substantial gainful activity. And so I don't know, but it's probably worth looking into if there are certain financial requirements for, as Mark was saying, we can easily push some of our folks out of eligibility for things that they were eligible for just simply because they're earning a decent living. And we run up against that from time to time with other eligibility programs. So I didn't know. I think it kind of fits in the first bullet, but it's something that probably bears some more research because, again, we take people who aren't working and turn them into taxpayers, and we've really been emphasizing people earning more and more wages.
Well, and Jim, this is Marshall. My experience has been, though, that a lot of times, especially getting some entry-level job, it's not enough for them to provide those services that they lost themselves. So they're kind of
good point.
Limbo, and that's one of the big deterrents from people getting a job. They have to get a job at such a high level of pay to function, so it's hard to find one like that. I mean, you know that. You see it every day, probably.
Yeah, and we're actually seeing more and more people going to work and getting full-time with benefits, too. Which is interesting, but again, those benefits may not cover the specific supports they need.
Mm-hmm.
So, we were kind of kicking it around the other day, and we were thinking it's probably something that we need to sort of make sure we've got lined up, because, again, more at the federal level, there's a big emphasis on folks earning more wages, and we're fine with that, so.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I couldn't. It's kind of like fits in between the two bullets, I guess. I don't know.
But I see what you're saying, that if we're trying to encourage the ability to remain living in the community, and someone can take advantage of that by receiving some type of long-term service and support, and yet by trying to stay independent, they try to get a job, then they're stuck with either they get the job and they may not get that, you know, for example, personal attendant that's going to help them get up in the morning and get to that job.
Right, and what has happened is traditionally folks earned a low enough amount that those services were still paid for, but as people are earning more and more, kind of like Marshall was saying, they're kind of in between. They don't qualify for the programs that were free to them, and they can't afford to purchase some of those supports, even with impairment-related work expense.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know how it was going to impact service rentality. It would probably wouldn't be the housing itself, but certainly some of the array of supports that folks might avail themselves of.
Well, I said before that this might be an opportunity to work on some of that gap through programs or whatever might be developed from this. Since, as far as I can see, there's no restriction on income and whatever of whoever serves. So acknowledging that barrier exists, I think, is a way for the council to look at possible things that this program could do to kind of reach some of those people in between.
I just want to let you know there is a Medicaid buy-in program specifically for this issue, because that is a real issue. Is, you know, you encourage some.
I know we run that program, but there's other supports. That,
right.
The other supports are the issues.
So,
I mean, it's a very real issue as people get better and they start working. And the other, and it's a related issue, that as some people get better and they lose the functional need for some of our programs. And so that's a sort of side issue.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things, I would say, and not necessarily a bear, but one of the good things about some of the HUD programs is as the income changes, you don't have to move out of your housing. You just pay more towards the housing and the subsidies go down. So, I mean, it's not often I say good things about HUD, but in that arena, those that developed with like the 811 programs and even some of the public housing authority, they, thank God, got away from to where as soon as you made above a certain level, you had to move, you know. So now I think that is a kind of a positive thing, but that's not necessarily the case in other benefits. The other thing I did want to point out, and I'm not quite sure if we want to be repetitious or if we feel like we've talked about this enough, but just the fact that the requirements of the various programs, because they're so different, do cause barriers to people. I mean, yeah, you know, qualifying under federal AMFI, area median family income, is the going thing in the housing side of the world, while the poverty level is the going thing in the service side of the level, generally speaking, I believe,
right,
for you service people. So I don't know if this is where we talk about that, or if we feel like we've already, you know, I mean, we obviously identified all of that as we began to have this discussion. So I just wanted
I think, Jean, this is a great time to talk about that, and I think that's a great point that maybe we can delve into a little bit further of that. The complexities of various, mostly federal programs, but some state programs as well, can create barriers, both through the fact that they are so complex, but also through the fact that they are all different and are asking for different things. So I don't know if we want to go down that road. I think that this is definitely the time to do it.
Well, and I think one of the things we've definitely learned and, you know, spent time putting together manuals about is that the whole people in the service side don't understand the housing terminology, and the housing people don't understand the service side terminology. So there's just, I mean, the whole reason I think for this council was the idea that we're talking foreign languages.
Mm-hmm.
Many times, you know. So, and I know that's a different committee. I mean, there's some issues about educating people on different within the state, the different agencies about the terminology. But you see that in the consumers and the providers. And I know with the independent living centers, they're like, there's, you know, been an effort to push them into housing, to doing more housing, which obviously makes sense. But they're really oftentimes lost on. As are the Easter Seals and the UCPs of the world. They're, you know, they're used to service arena, but not necessarily housing talk. So, anyway, I'm not sure. Maybe that's how we fit in some of the things in these barrier areas.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be quiet for a while.
I think it's a good point, and I think that during the April 22nd conference call of the cross-agency committee, they were taking on the fourth of the barriers that are in this chapter, which is the coordination barrier. And I think that has a lot to do with, you know, better communication and education So I think that that's definitely up their alley, and they're acknowledging it. But is, I mean, similarly though, I mean, is there something that we can say about the regulations and how the regulations have created a potential barrier? I know we mentioned Medicaid, but there are many others. I mean, for housing programs, you know, TDHCA offers, you know, what we offer between 18 and 20 different programs under our guise, and there's also many others that we don't control but are controlled either by the PHAs or the urban locations of participating jurisdictions, and that's just one agency. And I know that all our state representatives on the line know that you guys all have, you know, probably substantially more than we do as larger state agencies. So I don't know if there is anything to be said. I mean, what we can try to talk about that we want in this plan about barriers that exist at that level.
Any thoughts?
Well, I'm trying to understand. Well, I mean, I understand from the housing, you know, I mean, as a service person who's worked very hard trying to learn housing, you have your limitations too. I mean, you have your 202 funding versus 8011 funding, and then you have your different populations being segregated that way. There seems to be a limited amount of funding there. And it seems, too, that the housing money in the state of Texas is not controlled by any one entity. And that you have 475 public housing authorities, and each one can do its own sort of thing. And I think we have certainly found that very difficult to work with. So there's no central statewide policy from the housing perspective when you look at it from the human services side.
Right. No, that's definitely true. And I think, so would you think, Mark, that people from the services side find it harder to work with housing agencies because there is no central statewide policy program? Yet?
Well, you know, I only can speak from the state housing and services system, and I'm probably the one person who's really doing the most work in the housing environment because of promoting independence in the MFP, and we're finding it very difficult. I mean, we're approaching you, but like, for example, this new NOFA. Well, you get to apply, and 475 other public housing authorities get to apply.
Right.
We have really no coordinated effort, so it's like we and I believe we have developed a wonderful working relationship between us and y'all for MFP, but also we have to work with 475 other entities, and yeah, that's a lot of energy and repeating the same things over and keep on working. So that's very difficult. I mean, I think that just is very, very difficult. And I have to admit, you know, up to 4 or 5 years ago, I didn't even understand that TDHCA doesn't control, you know, the public policy or all the funding that comes into the state. So, yeah, I think that is certainly a barrier to trying to get effective coordinated programs and comprehensive programs going.
Mm-hmm. All right. Are there any other... anything else about state or federal regulations? I guess we got a little bit off from that, but kind of along the lines of the first statements that were made by Mark and Jim about different ways in which the current state of the policies for these programs make it so that we're not fully helping the entire population in need.
Well, there's one other issue I just keep on. It has to do with either HUD or the public housing authorities or I don't know who. One of the barriers seems to be with the definition of criminal history checks and providing services for individuals with behavioral health issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you, and Jean maybe can correct me on this one, that TDHCA doesn't, like, for example, in the Housing Tax Credit Program, which is our largest program, that we don't require criminal history checks, but that the property management companies, I dare say you would ever find one that wouldn't require the criminal history background check. And then you get into the HUD programs and the public housing authorities, and they're pretty, well, definitely if there's anything to do with drug use or production or anything of that nature, you know, you really cannot rent to any individual. And then the rest of it, there's some guidance that's given as far as felonies go. And then each individual property, HUD says, well, we want you to make sure you don't have anybody that would endanger anybody. So there's guidance given as far as that with felony convictions and the like. I mean, we as a provider have looked at 10 years. You know, going back more than 10 years will be okay about, unless it's something violent. And then we have to, the whole liability of who you're allowing to come in.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there is all kinds of stuff regarding that, which I do think are great, great, particularly those with any kind of behavioral disabilities and stuff. You're gonna, those are they are very limited as to where anybody can get housing.
Mm-hmm. And so, in terms of the guidance that you've received, is there some type of, I don't know, I know that, like, the IRS will put out, like, a guide on something. Does HUD put out those, like, kind of like a memo about that, or?
Yeah, there is, and I know they're in the manuals, particularly for the 811 program and the like.
Okay.
Where they talk, you might want to look at some of the criminal background. Now, Naomi's not in today, but I'll try to see if there's a link to any of this or if it's really the hard copy manuals that they're using these days.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see kind of what's out there since, TDHCA doesn't do 811, but I'm sure that there's probably some guidance on something that THCA does do that I'd like to look at that.
Yeah, criminal background checks are a difficult thing regarding some housing, particularly with certain disabilities.
Yeah, okay, great. Okay, well, if anyone has anything else on this, if not, we can move on to the administrative limitations. Anything else to say?
I wondered, Marshall, in learning the programs we have here, and then looking at some of the criteria for getting services, I'm suspecting that they're going to clash in some cases. If the same person is trying to get, say, first-time homebuyer assistance, now they can be a certain percent AMFI, like you said, that's done with a whole other criteria to the services. And yet, they have to be able to, they have to have a credit score that's a certain level, and they have to be able to qualify for a loan so they can pay it back. But how many people on Medicaid would fit that description?
That's a wonderful point. I mean, very few. I mean, by definition, you have to have almost no income. You have this SSI check of 674. Like, they can go up to 300% for some programs, which isn't really a lot of money, and you are limited by your resources. You can't have more than $10,000 in resources, so I doubt anybody's going to be working, and so for at least the Medicaid population, it's going to be almost impossible, I would say.
That's just one.
Well, not necessarily, and I always, this is Jane, and we've fought this battle a really long time. Not necessarily, it actually comes more on some of the, I guess, administrative limitations in the housing world or limitations on funding. Is the majority of the time the entities giving out the money want more bang for the buck. In other words, they don't want you to do deep subsidies. And the trick to get anybody into a home that has a limited income is to get them very deep subsidies. And what we do is, for people going through the home ownership process, is we layer a lot of financing. And so if you can bring the cost of the house down, then people, you'll be surprised how much, instead of paying their money to rent a property, they can actually, afford to own. And also, like USDA funding provides, is like a HUD voucher, or even there's uses for HUD vouchers towards home ownership. So it's, some of it's attitudinal. I mean, truthfully, we've had to work just to, point out the barriers that people with disabilities have because of their income and because of their limitations when they receive certain subsidies
to not have a bunch of savings. That's the other big barrier if you're looking at home ownership. They say, well, they need to have more money in the bank. Well, they're not allowed to because then they're going to lose their benefits. So there's been issues, and our solution to much of this is deep subsidies. In other words, you get down the amount they're going to have for a mortgage into something that is payment, or they get a voucher that is used for home ownership. So there are barriers, and we have chapters written on that. I can give you all that on home ownership because it is a barrier, and it is a lot of education to those who do funding to make them understand for people with disabilities there are serious limitations due to the programs not allowing them to save any money.
Mm-hmm.
And another side in the whole arena where people talk about asset building, and they have programs to where you can get match from lenders or something to save more. Well, again, you have the limitation of how much you can have in the bank, or any of the federally funded programs, which is very, very sad, but they only match earned income, not income that comes from benefits. So there's a lot of barriers in those arenas for people to participate in some of the benefit programs for the general population of low-income people, to kind of bring them up to be able to afford a home.
So do you, what kind of benefits or programs are you talking about, you referencing there?
What kind of benefits? You mean as far as SSDI? No, SSDI.
Were you saying that for those that only match earned income, not benefits, is that what you were talking about?
Yes. Those are the, what are they called? I don't, I'm missing my terminology now. I know you all know about them. Woody Woodrow does all of the big ones. Why am I not thinking? It's Friday.
Their savings account.
Yes.
Is that like Miller Trust?
No. They're programs out there, and they're really been promoted a whole lot.
Savings accounts.
Yeah. What do they call the savings accounts? What are they, match savings accounts? Or?
Yeah, I mean, that's in essence what they are. Yeah, individual puts in, $50 a month, some entity, like I know Wells Fargo has one, they'll put $50 in a month as well.
Right.
Yeah,
but it's only based on earned income, which really, really messes up people that are able to say they stay with their families until they're trying to save for a home, and they're going to stay with their families, and they're putting their money away, and had they been able to be participating in one of these programs, asset building or, gosh, I need to pull something from around my office. I know I've got tons of literature on it, but right now I'm totally blanking on the terminology.
But the description that Paige gave is right on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just know that it's independent savings account.
Okay.
But I know them as, but.
Okay.
Yeah, but there's a term for them.
Okay. So, but the point being is that there isn't the ability to use your benefits to put towards that match to really have any basis for receiving like you were saying, like a home ownership like loan or something like that?
Correct. You can't build it up like IDAs, individual development accounts.
There you go.
I'm sorry. There's IDAs, individual development accounts out there, which are set up for individuals to save money towards something big. Primarily, it's for a home or education, where people with disabilities, that they're excluded because they don't have earned income. You know, it's a match to earned income. I mean, that's just one example of some of the barriers that are out there for people that are trying to build assets.
Okay.
And I can get, we've got a lot of language on these things. I'm just.
Okay, great.
So I'll send you some different chapters from our stuff on barriers for people with disabilities regarding home ownership and savings.
Okay, yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah, again, the majority of people with disabilities are not homeowners, but,
right.
You know.
No, though.
Yeah.
And I think it's good to mention, even if maybe we're focusing on a renter population.
Yeah. There's just regulations like that are barriers.
Right.
And, you know, the fact that most people with disabilities aren't homeowners is also a problem in a way, because when you own your own home, you can modify it like you need it without having to ask permission and all that kind of stuff.
Right, and you're investing in something. Yeah, yeah.
And you're investing in it, you make it like you want it. But if you live in an apartment, that's a whole different animal.
Right.
So that means to me that a lot of people are living in places that aren't set up as well as they should be for them because they're having to rent.
Correct. Yeah.
But
actually, the numbers you look at as far as people with disabilities when you do the broad census stuff, I mean, there are larger numbers of homeowners, but when you think about if somebody self-identifies as having trouble with daily living, a lot of times they're elderly and they've acquired the disability later in life. So I don't want, because if people start doing statistical looks at this, they're going to say, no, there's a whole lot of homeowners, and yes, there are, but it's, you know, it's they become disabled later in life, and they've already owned a home.
Right. Okay, why don't we move forward on then to discussing administrative limitations. I want to make sure we get to talk about each of these. And so when we say administrative, I think that we were focusing on official policies or procedures or rules that exist within state agencies, rather than state or federal laws, and what is it has become a potential barrier towards this effort to create service-enriched housing. So, anyone have any thoughts?
I think again for us it was one of the challenges. That ties, it's sort of a common theme that we're running across that may cut across this and it may not, and it's a barrier now with some goals to improve it, is the time limitations on our support and funding. And again, I'm not sure that it necessarily ties to the housing per se, but it certainly ties to the enriched part. And for example, back in the 90s, when then MHMR had quite a lot of funding available for employment for people with disabilities, a lot of general revenue, we used to kind of do sort of a front-end, back-end deal where we would provide, TRC then, Texas Rehabilitation Commission, would cover the initial expenses of somebody, you know, supportive employment, somebody going to work, job coaching, and then when we close case, MHMR would pick it up. Well, as the DD side and on the other side moved more towards waiver service, there's less and less general revenue. There's a huge gap there now, policy-wise. We have a number of situations where we have folks that need continued support, sort of behavioral support on a job, who might actually be living, you know, qualified to live in these kind of settings. And right now there's a disconnect, and so that's the likelihood of support continuing is challenging right now. So for us, it's the time limitations on our funding of certain supports in our VR program and in our independent living program. So that's the one issue we have to address. And it's more of the barrier is more of the link, the lack of the link between the time-limited supports of GARS and long-term supports right now.
And we're talking, and this is just from education, we're talking just with the support of housing, and we defined housing as either like multifamily or a single apartment or a home-like type of setting. And some of the things that we've talked about before, and I don't know if we're going into the area of like we use vouchers and all that, but there's been a question about the way the administrative timing, when your time goes with your contractors and when they have to get expenditures of certain dollars, and the timing of the service system when they need to get working together and possibilities then of losing housing because we can't put those two time frames together. Is that something we're talking about here?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that that's a good point. And to make sure that I get what you're saying, I think I'm understanding that I think we mentioned this before, that, from a developer standpoint, trying to get money when a NOFA comes out, a Notice of Funding Availability comes out for a program, and then also either being able to, I mean, I know we're not talking about having a developer also provide the services, but to be able to hook up with or partner with a service provider that has also been able to receive their funding and work those together. I think that's what you're saying is that the timing of when funding becomes available for the housing side versus the services side, sometimes there's a disconnect there?
Yes. I mean, there was a discussion a couple years ago, and I think Brooke Boston put it up, this huge work group from TBHCA, the barriers in administering the HUD funds, and this was like a big issue, and I don't see where it's really gone away, so yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely see what you're talking about there.
One of the other barriers that exists is a lot of times that the different funders have the requirement that they are the funder of last resort. Well, and this is particularly true in the human services side, I don't know about the housing side, but if everybody says they have to be the funder of last resort, then nobody pays. And so that becomes really complicated for the consumer when they're trying to blend different sources of funding together to build a support package that they need.
Yeah, I see that.
Not funder of last resort, payer of last resort.
Okay. That's a good point.
The only other thing I think could be barriers is, and it ties to the funding piece, but although there are state contracting requirements, it seems that each agency has its own little nuances of what it takes to do business. And so let's say you have a program that wants to develop or that wants to build something and be a provider of services. That person may have to go into numerous contracting relationships that have different requirements, different liability requirements, and all sorts of other pieces. And that would be pretty difficult for them to navigate through.
Yeah, I would second that. This is Jean. And I guess it's a administrative limitation, or if there was somehow a task force at the state level of the different agencies that contract or award grants out to somehow get the application processes similar in overall. In other words, like at the federal level, if you apply for federal funds, there's the one type form that you usually have that you gather the same information on. You know what I'm saying? And I can't think of the name of the form, but there's like a cover sheet that, you know, you check off what congressional district you're in and all of those, that the majority of federal funds all have that same kind of cover sheet. And even if we could get the state agencies to have something similar to that, that would be so helpful for those of us out in the community that try to do programming. And if you think about going to another state agency, you know, if you had some commonality there, it would really help as far as developing some of these initiatives that bring in different kinds of funding sources. And I know there's a House bill that is looking at nonprofits' capacity and all that, but I think they're looking at some of these similar things. But I think it's worth being said that just there could be efforts, or there's barriers to being or groups that are trying to serve people with disabilities or others in housing and partner even with others on services that you understand all the different agencies' ways of doing business.
Okay, great. Right. Is there any other administrative limitations that...
Well, I don't know if this is a true statement or not, but certainly on the voucher side, there's always that complaint that the administrative part that's being offered is not worth going for the NOFA. That, you know, are we making this attractive enough for people to want to actually play with us? And again, I don't know if that's true on the income, on the tax credit side as it is on the voucher side, but that's certainly something we've heard through that process.
Yeah, the percentage offered to cover admin costs oftentimes does not really cover a provider's costs. So they have to really evaluate whether or not they can raise the additional money that they need to cover the costs in order to use to apply for the program.
Yeah, and I can definitely speak from that, from being out in the field, is we've tried to promote others to get into some of the housing, or from the service side, to get into the housing areas, and they look at it and they're kind of like, well, where's the operating money? How do you do this? It's great people get, you know, assistance and all, but how do you have staff people to do that? So it is about, you have to be able to go out and raise other funding sources, where in some of the service side of things, that's what it's about. There's operating money in there.
Right. And I think that that's something that staff has definitely heard from the cross-agency committee as well, when talking about ways to make it easier to, you know, streamline programs and funding sources from the state to the local level, is that some local providers have simply given up on certain types of state funding due to the limited administrative portion that they can put towards administrative costs. And that, I believe, is a state regulation, right?
Oh, it's the home money, it's a HUD regulation.
Okay.
I mean, it's a HUD thing. You only get, the entity only gets 10%. So TDHA generally on the administrative side gives out 4%. They keep 6 for people with disabilities. They've been flipping it because it's so hard for organizations to be able to do anything with the funds, that they go 6%, or have in the past, 6% admin for the entity out in the field and 4% for the state.
Yeah, and, you know, there's those limitations, but the state could put in additional money to pay for it. For example, we did this UPI way back when, where we actually, for a two-year period, we actually transferred some dollars so you could pay what a... Gene, was a 6% admin fee or an 8% admin fee?
Right, and then other money was used to bring it up to a 10%, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You can supplement that.
Yeah.
So what happened then with that, Mark, that you're talking about?
Well,
it was general revenue that came from the other side, right, Mark?
Yeah, it came actually through our promoting independence fund.
Yeah.
I keep on recommending it, and somehow it hasn't happened. I think we bumped into the 2003 budget crisis of that year,
mm-hmm.
and that money then was taken away. So it's something we can look at, certainly. And but talking generally, you know, I think if we're looking at these barriers and obstacles, there are other ways of supplementing that admin fee.
Yeah. Okay. Agreed. Okay. So do we want to go to, I mean, we're kind of already talking about it, limitations on funding, and so I think that we can refer to either state or federal program sources of funding. Any thoughts about, I mean, I guess it kind of does tie into what we've already discussed with regulation, but...
Well, I can tell you from the development side, and I think Ann O'Hara's presentation at the summit was really good to talk about the 811. I mean, it had potential, it had a whole lot of potential to create more housing back in the day when it actually used to have, it used to fund everything. And then obviously with federal budget cuts, it became the only way you could do it is to get some kind of local match. And now it's gotten to where it's, there's hardly any, you know, local funds to get that it's not producing. So they're trying, you know, to redesign it to put it more in line with what could be done with tax credits or something like that. So I think there's been tons of federal cuts in the housing funds over the last 8 years, 10 years, that, you know, some funding used to be out there. Granted, some of the limitations on how it can be developed have been put in place, which some of us really support, but it's still some of the funding aspects of it. And the whole vouchers, I mean, look across the state of Texas at the waiting list. I mean, some of our urban areas for Section 8 vouchers, there's, you know, 2-3 years they're not even taking applications.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, I think that it'd be definitely worth mentioning, and I'm sure you all have a lot of information on it, but the whole lack of funding for housing.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about that, I did a totally unrelated to the council project where I called up and interviewed our tenant-based rental assistance providers, our TBRA providers, as they are for many people an alternative to Section 8, at least in the short term, because they provide rental assistance up to 2 years in kind of the same way as that a voucher does. And so, you know, this, I can see if maybe we want to use that kind of qualitative interview information to show the barrier there, because the administrators of the TBRA funds were giving me a lot of feedback about Section 8 in their areas and the status of people who will go through the entire 24 months on the TBRA and then still come out without being moving from the Section 8 waiting list.
And that, right, and that's, you know, obviously that's a big problem, you know, with myself as a person that we're encountering a lot. And I think that's a very real issue, because if we can get some housing out there and we're going to be dependent on using some vouchers to pay for some of this housing, then if you don't have the housing vouchers, you're kind of screwed.
Well, and that was a huge issue early on. I mean, it was great that back when it was allocated, TDHA allocated tons of home money in the tenant-based rental through home funds. But I think some of us recognized it at the time that they're short-term, and many of the independent living centers, very probably rightly so, said, I'm not going to be responsible for getting somebody out for 2 years and then send them back in,
right?
You know, and I understood what they were saying. I was probably, you know, the advocate more to, well, you know, let's get out and see what we can do. But I understand where they were coming from, and so that turned out to not be any kind of panacea for the problem. I mean, some people have successfully done it, and I think TDHA has been willing to stretch it a little bit as much as HUD would, you know, allow. To continue contracts and, you know, to allow people to be there and see what they could do to get
right.
people on regular vouchers, but it's so risky. It really, really is.
So actually, that becomes one of the barriers, and the TBRA is only good for 2 years.
Correct.
But there can't be some sort of renewal, automatic renewal process when, in fact, you can't find permanent housing. So they won't put that down as one of your administrative or regulatory barriers.
Right now, as HOME have been, they're kind of in a review process of their programs and program rules, and I have heard discussion of, you know, what kind of renewal or extension could be provided, and what kind of possibilities there could be around that. So I know that discussion has been started for sure. And we can definitely make sure that we mention it here in Chapter 5 as well.
Okay. And from the Human Services side, when you're talking about funding, how many ways can I count the problem here? I mean, you know, funding, again, certainly for Medicaid, even though there's a lot of money being spent, there seems to always be a greater need. So, you know, institutional care is an entitlement. Community-based programming are either optional or waivered programs, which can be limited by state funding. So it doesn't seem to be enough funding or services to provide individuals. Again, we're only talking about the very, 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 very poor, the people at 17 to 90% median average income. But the very poor seem not to have services. And then again, when you talk, I know a lot of our conversations that I do with, certainly with service and rich housing and working with individuals with behavioral health issues, there's very limited general revenue funding for those programs. So funding's obviously a big problem in providing the services. And you may find the housing, but you're not going to find the services.
And can I ask you, Mark, and also Jim and Jonas, because I know, obviously, of what programs that the TDHCA provides through state funding, there are very few because we don't receive a whole lot of state funds, but that funding does tend to be more flexible. On the services side, is there any such kind of similar, more flexible funding, and what does it go towards if so?
Well, I'll speak for the Department of Aging and Disability Services. Most of our funding is Medicaid, so there's not a lot of flexibility once you establish those financial and functional criteria. I mean, you can write certain rules and change things, but that always then impacts the overall funding. We have a little bit of administration on aging funding, and there's a little bit of flexibility how those dollars can be spent, but again, those are very limited. In terms of general revenue, we have very little general revenue funding. I mean, it's almost non-existent compared to the big hippopotami in the room, and that's going to be Medicaid. And even though we don't have any representatives from State Health Services, I do know that they're funding too. Now, they have usually a little more general revenue funding than others, but again, they have a little bit of flexibility in terms of how they spend up. But the legislature, they're pretty stringent in terms of how they want those dollars to be spent.
We have flexibility within the scope. You know, our dollars are basically 4-to-1 match to draw down federal regular funds through the VR grant. And for going to work, we have lots of flexibility in terms of what services or supports we purchase, provided that they're geared towards going to work. Probably where we would also have flexibility that could apply here is in independent living services. We also have counselors who have case service funds and can purchase supports that folks require to increase the level of independence in their home. The majority of stuff we buy in that program is equipment for home things for the home and things along those lines. So there's pretty good flexibility there. And of the two programs, I think those are probably two of our programs that would impact that. And of course, we have deaf and hard of hearing services, which is a combination of state TR and other funds through I'm blanking on PUC, Public Utility Commission, and also they draw down some VR revenue because they provide VR-related services. And so services to folks who are deaf or hard of hearing in terms of specialized equipment, we also have lots of flexibility that, to improve access. Through the PUC, we're able to get people equipment. And then in blind services, too, we're pretty flexible. So if a person needs, losing their sight or has lost their sight, they can access in-home support and off-site training in mobility and independent living and all that. So we're pretty flexible. Both the VR programs have independent living services, and it's pretty much up to the counselor's discretion. As long as it's something that gets put in the plan, the counselor can do it.
So everyone's looking at DARS now, huh? No, I'm joking.
Except DARS, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys really don't have a lot of money, per se, to spend that, right?
Well, it depends on what's needed for the person to go to work. And we, like everybody else, we have to use comparable benefits first. So we don't pay for medical procedures if the person has insurance, and all those other pieces. So obviously we use comparable benefits, but you know, for us, it's a manpower issue because of the FTE cap in the state, as it is in most of the states. The VR funds are there, but we're not able to draw them down, and we're limited to the number of people we can serve. But, you know, again, so there are wait lists for services and independent living, but within the scope, when we do have somebody on the caseload, the counselors have flexibility.
Okay. But the independent living money you're talking about is still tied toward employment search?
No. Independent living is funded entirely. It's not. The law was written when they reauthorized rehab back in the early 70s to include an outcome of increasing independence in the home as an acceptable outcome of VR services, which I know sounds kind of weird. Independent living services can fund vocational rehab, but we keep it separate in Texas. But no, a person does not have to be looking to go to work to get independent living services.
Well, some states have allocated that money over to the SILP or the centers, but they don't do that here.
No, that's an entirely different funding source. We're Part B funds, that's Part C funds, and there's some of the money goes directly to the SILP. To the centers. Some of the money, you know, we get allocated through state GR, and then some of the centers are funded with a combination of both. But those are Part C funds, and they require no match. Part B funds are strictly for independent living services. And not every state accesses. In fact, we don't, we draw down very little federal money for our Part B independent living services. The way we fund it is through our SSAVR reimbursement. We get reimbursed through SSA for closures. When a person works at SDA or above for 8 months, we have a cost reimbursement. And so that's actually how we fund independent living services in Texas, is with money that comes back to us from the VR system.
Okay. Thank you for that. Did not know any of that.
So I know that when I was in the state of Washington, there was a lot of discussion about the Part B money being taken, you know, VR giving that over to the actual centers and the SILP and stuff like that. So,
VR has no say in that. That's the president's, but that's Congress and how they determine the funds. And just about every president since Bush's first term has, you know, when they present their budget, they consolidate the Part B and Part C funds, and then everybody says, okay, which one's not going to require a match, and they end up separating them again. Same thing with the supported living funds and the Title I funds. They're usually proposed in the same budget, but they usually get separated. But you know, it's not VR's call to give up money per se. And again, we're funding it. We're not even funding it with regular VR. We're not even funding it with regular federal money. We're using our. We made a decision. The program would shut down if we had not allocated funding through SSA VR reimbursement to it.
What's SSA VR reimbursement?
We are under our contract, under with the Social Security Administration. If a person, we get cost reimbursement methodology. If a person goes to work, maintains SDA, substantial gainful activity, or at least the SDA, for at least 9 of 12 months, we get the money we spent on that case back from Social Security. Not all of it, but categorical funding. And that money comes back to us. So ours last year, I think, generated somewhere around $10 million. From that, we use about $3 million to fund independent living services and the rest of it to fund all the other things that get thrown at us that are mandated and unfunded.
Okay. That's very interesting. I want to make sure we get through as much as possible. Here, I just wanted to ask one of the questions that I had put on the discussion handout that we haven't exactly touched on is, in our efforts to increase service-enriched housing, have you encountered something within your agency that would limit that goal, either that
service mesh housing couldn't happen because of this policy, this funding source, or if maybe the impacts of trying to redirect funding towards service mesh housing would, you know, just outweigh the gains. So, I mean, I just kind of want to know, you know, if we're shooting for this, you know, service mesh housing, what currently is a barrier of making that kind of end goal realized?
Well, I could if you want to talk external environments, because I think we were talking more internal environments, but I think if you're looking externally, which is a good way to kind of focus, is I think we would have pushback from some of the developer if we were to try to direct, say, tax credits into promoting some of this. I think we might have some pushback from the private providers or the in the housing world, the for-profit developers who really don't want to get into this, you know, or have another layer of requirement or something that they would see as burdensome. So I do think this isn't necessarily recommendations are, you know, are just going to go merrily along on the housing side, because it would create change. And anytime you create change and people that are good at doing what they're doing, you know, as far as developing certain standard designed apartment complexes, et cetera, you know, they're going to see a loss in their opportunities. So that's just my thing as far as looking at external. I know in the housing arena we'd probably have some resistance. And probably in the service side also, Mark, wouldn't you think? The for-profit providers who now develop group homes or something of that nature, if there's more emphasis that the Medicaid waivers are to be used in, you know, other living type situations or something of that nature.
Yeah.
Change is tough. People don't like it.
Right.
Especially if they've already got an in. Right? You know what I'm saying? They've already got a business model that's working for them.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know, if things go more managed care.
Well, and I think you can expect.
Yeah, things are
going to for, you know, this next legislative session, I'd be very surprised if the discussion doesn't center around an expansion to managed care for long-term services. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I know there's going to be the conversation.
Absolutely. And if some of those things happen and you put it into more of a managed care, more of a community living environment, it would be good for something of this nature, I think. But it will definitely change Texas as far as our current arrangement in both sides, but definitely the service side of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how you articulate that without, you know, I mean, but it's a reality, and it's probably, if you look at other states that have tried, you know, different directing their funding, like even North Carolina, how they've directed some of theirs, vouchers, I think there was a lot of resistance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say that for those of you who attended the summit and listened to Anne speak, she was talking about North Carolina and how they had used money from Section 811 as a way to, what was it exactly? It was like a set-aside for all of their housing tax credit properties. They set aside some money, or set aside some units, sorry, for persons with disabilities. And then I think what was, Gene, or someone can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the set-aside for persons with disabilities of each tax credit property, then there was some money from 811 that was put into that? Or
no, it was state funding.
It was state funding.
Yeah.
Okay.
But still, it was no longer an option. It was a requirement. And I know they had, I mean, because they presented at our last summit, and they really said, you know, you know, it wasn't easy. Change isn't easy, but now it's the threshold kind of thing. You know, it's just what's expected. But I think playing off again of the issues that came out of the summit is another external barrier or issue is the inability of the lack of availability of transportation in some of the suburban areas where the developers want to develop their properties because the land's cheaper. You know, so, I mean, there are those external things that are driving the housing development that, you know, should we say for service and rich housing, it's going to be a priority. I mean, say we're that lucky to get, you know, some kind of priority put on it. Then with that, of course, the service and rich housing, we say accessible, and accessible means available transportation and the like. So you're going to, I mean, there's going to be those external barriers to any kind of development, which may be a whole other chapter. And I think a lot of it, the report that the National Council did, I think they talk a lot in some of the barriers in general to serving people with disabilities.
I know that when I was planning on moving down here, we seriously talked about going into an outlying suburb, but we couldn't because there wouldn't be any public transportation, say from Round Rock or somewhere up there. And we were afraid that there would be a limited number of people we could hire to do like personal assistant work when you get out further away in the rural areas. So, you know, land's cheaper, you can do things better there that way, but then if you need services, they're not as hard.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think that's something that I think this summit really highlighted as, if we're talking about accessibility and having accessible service and rich housing, that's definitely one of the factors we have to consider.
And
okay.
I think one of the other things that hopefully won't be a barrier, you know, for an extended period of time, but just educating people about what is service and rich housing and what does that mean?
So you think you're saying that could be a potential barrier is the lack of understanding?
Mm-hmm. Both for providers and for the consumer community.
I totally agree. I think it's already there when people say it. They think they're afraid we're going over to the edge into institutional care.
You know, there was quite a discussion at the summit on a panel that I facilitated when we were talking about just innovative things that were going on at the state level, and I talked about, you know, the Housing and Health Services Committee and how innovative that is that all of these agencies and public members are sitting around the table talking to each other for the first time about the service side and the housing side and, you know, ADAPT piped right up and said, you know, why are you building models that put together transportation and housing, and they immediately thought we were talking about institutional type services like assisted living, and that you couldn't have one without the other. And so I think there's going to be a real real focus on education, that we're not going backwards, and that this is a new concept, and this is what it means.
Yeah, definitely. I think that is a good, you know, something that we can segue this chapter into our next steps. That's kind of how we're going to conclude the biennial plan is this whole next steps. And I think that's something that a focus on educating people to make sure that we don't have those misconceptions is important.
As a consumer, this is Felix. As a consumer, yeah, I'm gonna have to look into that too. Into how is the public gonna be able to catch on to this program that we want to put out there?
Definitely. Okay. Great. We're at about 3:20 now. I don't want to keep people too long. If you have any last thoughts about barriers we want to discuss today, please shout them out. Otherwise, we can go on to possible staff assignments
for this chapter and next steps for the committee. Okay. So, from what I've heard today, it looks like Jean's going to do some research for me and get me some information.
Yes, I am. I'll send you stuff you can play with however you want as far as barriers go.
Great. And also the HUD manuals.
Yeah, HUD manuals. You got it. Okay. For criminal background.
Great. And also some follow-up, Mark, if you have anything that you want to give me from Dad's as to, you know, research done on needs that we talked about the last conference call, that would be great, too. Are there any research requests that we have in terms of this chapter that we want to make sure that me and Marshall start on?
Mark, I've been working on that new NOFA you were mentioning.
Oh, good.
And I have done two trainings with webinars with it about how we're eligible, who's eligible, all the little ins and outs of it. And I know we've got a meeting on the 10th after the council meeting to discuss all that. You're going to be there, right?
Yes, I am. Yeah, I've been listening to everything, and Steve's been listening, and Steve's coordinating all those efforts. So that's really been a big part of our focus is that NOFA. And like I was saying, when I said when we started off this whole conversation with the public housing authorities, you know, we're working all sides of the coin here, you know, because we have to. So it's
I wondered how this might or might not fit into the work of the council, but it's limited to people on the waiting list. So we have to, it has to, these two categories and both of them have to be go toward people on the waiting list that are already on the waiting list. And if you take care of all of them, then you have to open up your waiting list, which I understand our waiting list isn't closed, but we only have 20 people in project access, and I think she said about 140-something people with this Section 8 vouchers of disabilities. And we qualify, we meaning PDHCA, just the PHA that we are for the state, we qualify for 100 vouchers.
Right.
Would it be helpful? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were done. I'll wait.
What?
So go ahead, Jeff.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Maybe you've done this, but I was kind of harkening back to some of our earlier discussions about the various eligibility criteria, the various financial requirements. Have we done kind of a crosswalk or a side-by-side or side-by-side-by-side of various eligibility requirements for the support services that are in state that are available to a person? And I don't know, you almost may have to pick a person or pick a disability or pick a circumstance, but I'm thinking, you know, Medicaid waiver, community center, VR, you know, all of those. And in both in terms of impact of disability or impact of your circumstances and also financial criteria, we might find there's some similarities or we may find that we're just all over the map. I mean, you know, we work with kids in school. We always say you go from, from entitlement to waiting lists. And we were, so I don't know. I mean, maybe it's been done already, but we've had numerous discussions about the related services that people could get in service nurse housing, but I'm wondering if we've ever kind of done an analysis of what the competing or compatible eligibility requirements are for all of these services.
Well, I can say that Marshall and I, that was definitely a project that we started. We looked, I was looking at the different possible housing programs and what their eligibility criteria and financial criteria were. Marshall started looking at DADS and comparing the DADS financial criteria and eligibility. And we want to also look at DARS, look at DISHES, make sure that we cover all of the state agencies that are represented at this council to make sure we can have some type of, yeah, like side-by-side comparison, as you said. It's quite large.
And say it's quite an arduous task, isn't it?
And what I'm grappling with, and we kind of came across this when we started doing it, is how to present that information in a way that the reader of the plan is going to easily understand and not get lost and swamped in the sheer volume. So, but I think that's a good point, though, that maybe finding, you know, where there is some overlap, or maybe pointing out the fact that there is very little overlap.
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, in my part of it, I have not lived in the state since the 80s. I was coming in like somebody just moved to the state, and as if I were looking for those services. And some of it was easy to find, some of it was really hard to find, and a lot of it was hard to understand what you qualify for.
Right.
The other thing, the question mark I have is, we have, what, 35 Centers for Infant Living or something like that. How can they, with their resources and their what they do, how can they plug into this at all?
Well, I think, you know, every center offers their core services, their information referral and support services. What tends to happen is, I think they should be a player in this discussion. They tend to have pretty limited budgets, so they very often don't have any direct client service funds available, but certainly can provide some support to people. I think there's currently 26 in Texas. The SILC plan calls for 42, but we're a long way away from there.
I think that our cross-agency committee is looking at local service provider networks or local organizations that try to link people with various service providers in their community. So hopefully we can touch upon that with that committee. Are there any other staff research requests for this chapter? Something that we can do to make sure that we're highlighting everything we want to for identifying barriers?
I will talk with our eligibility staff, Ashley, and see if we've got some crosswalks that are already developed.
Okay.
That would be helpful.
That'd be great.
Or some of the Medicaid programs and then their interaction with the programs that are funded through general revenue.
Okay, that'd be great. Thank you. Okay, great. And then next steps. And we do still have a lot to cover. In terms of our next conference call, which will be the second Thursday in May, which I believe is the 12th. Am I right? 13? 13. Thank you. I wanted to just open it up to see if you know anyone had any ideas of or opinions about where we should go next. I think that we're doing very well in discussing various chapters of the biennial plan and getting a lot of information out there. We can certainly spend a conference call reviewing what staff has created and giving feedback on that, or if we want to continue to have discussions on various chapters, we can do that. Does anyone have any opinions or preferences?
It might be a good time to just take a step back and see what staff has come up with.
Okay.
See, you know, kind of get the big picture again and see how that fits in with the scheme.
Okay. Well, we can certainly do that, and I can I'm going to be getting with Jonas to kind of do an initial, you know, review of some of the things that staff has put together, and then we can pass it out to the entire committee, and maybe on May 13th we can have a discussion about any modifications or changes to drafts that staff has come up with.
So I think that's a great idea.
The only caveat I would give to that, and I will review what you sent me over the weekend, but we need to get that out to folks as soon as possible.
Sure.
They have time to review it and think about it.
Yes, I agree with you, Jonas.
So I will get what you sent to me back to you on Monday.
Okay, thank you so much. And I will try to have a quick turnaround in getting everyone the documents. And I'm going to try to put together Chapter 5 based on the conversations that we've had and that I've had with the cross-agency committee. So thank you, everyone, for attending on a Friday afternoon, and I look forward to giving you guys what we've come up with.
Okay. Ashley,
all right.
One more thing.
Mm.
On April 13th, CMS is going to be visiting with me, and so I don't know about my availability that day.
Okay.
That will be the second day of a 2-day visit.
Okay.
And so you're just going to have to put me down as a question mark in terms of my attendance.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
All right. And then I think we're going to try to go back to the 10:30 a.m. On Thursday, May 13th.
Okay.
So I will put you down as a question mark.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
We're sorry. Your conference is ending now. Please hang up.
Thank you for calling the AT&T Teleconference Replay System.